Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Scott Tobias
and
Genevieve Kosky,
and in spirit, Tasha Robinson, who will be back next episode, or she's in big trouble. On the first half of this episode, we looked at Stop Making Sense, the late Jonathan Demme's masterful Talking Heads concert film from 1984. In this half, we'll shift our focus a bit to what would be Demme's final film, another concert movie, Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids. Like Stop Making Sense, the film runs a mere 90 minutes, and it makes that time count, even though we go almost 9 full minutes before the music starts. Instead of jumping into the action, Demme introduces us to Timberlake and his musicians, all of whom are at the end of a tour that's lasted for more than a year. The intent is to go out with a bang, with a 2-night stand at Las Vegas' MGM Grand. As with Stop Making Sense, Demme condenses 2 concerts into 1 and builds the excitement throughout. But this is in many ways a different movie. It's hard to imagine, for instance, David Byrne holding hands with the band for a pre-concert prayer. And where Stop Making Sense works through many tones, Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids tries to own one. Sophisticated pop entertainment.
Tennessee Kids, y'all ready? Yeah. Tennessee Kids, y'all ready? Yeah. Vegas, y'all ready? Let me see you clap.
So let's just, you know, get right to it. What did you guys think of Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids?
I mean, I think I've been in the tank for this movie from the beginning. I think I pushed this movie on at least one of you guys. I really like it, and not just because it's Jonathan Demme. Like, I mean, I like Justin Timberlake. I'm not a super fan, but he is definitely one of those artists that, like, I like enough that I would maybe like to see him in concert.
Sure.
But probably not pay hundreds of dollars to see him at the MGM Grand. Yeah. You know, like, this is the way I would most like to see Justin Timberlake, and it is exactly what I want in that regard.
Though I have to say, you know, on the evidence of this film, you know, you get a solid amount of entertainment for your dollar.
Yeah.
The performance is just incredible. I really like this film a lot, and I think, you know, again, those Demme values, both in the way he makes the film and the spirit that animates the film, is so present, you know, in a way that just completely surprised me when I saw it. I guess I shouldn't be surprised because it is Jonathan Demme, but, you know, the film premiered, when it premiered at Toronto, I gave it a miss, because there's a lot of other things to see, but it wasn't like, I didn't feel a huge urgency because I never had that huge a connection to Justin Timberlake, either with NSYNC or as a solo performer. And I do kind of regret not seeing it. You know, they showed it on it wasn't an IMAX film, but they showed it on the biggest possible screen there.
Sure.
And I really regret not seeing it in that context. But I was blown away by it. I mean, you know, the just production of it, the musicianship, and just Justin Timberlake's dynamism and range as a performer, somebody who can sing and who can dance, who can play piano, who can play guitar. I mean, the guy is amazing.
Yeah, like he was grown in a petri dish to be a pop star. Yeah. And that petri dish is Orlando, Florida.
Born in Memphis, so
true. But he came up with NSYNC. Yeah. and I think he actually started out in Orlando with the Mickey Mouse Club, and then NSYNC.
Speaking of Peter, cool.
Sort of the Lou Pearlman school, right?
Yeah, I know my JT history.
You do, which is going to come in handy as this conversation goes on. But Keith, I already knew what Genevieve thought about this film. What did you think of
it? Oh, that was terrific. And I kind of, sorry I didn't get to see it in a theater.
Yeah, it didn't have a theatrical run.
No,
right?
it's
Netflix exclusive.
Yeah, which is a whole other issue we can get into. But yeah, it so many Netflix things just feel like afterthoughts, and it's not a fault of the films, because this is a, you know, terrific film, but it doesn't feel like it's, you know, this ought to be kind of a cultural event when it came out, and it ended up just being like another thing to watch on Netflix,
A Netflix problem. I honestly think this film would have made a lot more top 10 lists had it come out in a theater and not just been thrown onto to Netflix, just because of how much people love Jonathan Demme and how accomplished the film is.
It's a terrific piece of filmmaking. I mean, I don't think it stopped making sense. And the ambition is a little lower here, because there's kind of one tone gone through the whole thing, which is, I'm going to be the dapper, highly accomplished pop performer for you for 90 minutes versus, you know, a journey through life with all kinds of lighting changes and all that. But there's the stage structure. It's amazing. And there are some genuinely stop making sense, like moments where with using the shadows of the performers and things like that. It's all really nicely done. And he's terrific too. I like his music. I have a hard time making it through a whole Justin Timberlake album, but I love it when I encounter his songs in a mix of some other songs. But
yeah, well, and especially like this is the 2020 experience tour, and the 2020 experience was two albums.
It was too much. I remember that being really hard to get all the way through.
The second one especially was quite bloated. I mean, there are some great songs on there. Mm-hmm. I think Suit and Tie is great. Mirrors is the song that closes this, and I think it's a very effective closer. It's probably the biggest hit off of those albums, but. Yeah, but I think like by being centered on this album, it does. There are some moments that drag because of that, but you know, he does. You get your sexy back. You get your
rock your body.
Yeah, rock your body. Mm-hmm. So you know, you get the necessities, but it's
your little Michael Jackson.
Yeah,
shout
little
out
human
there.
Nature mm-hmm. there. Yeah,
yeah, it's nice.
Poison.
I mean, it's not the most obvious. Yeah, oh, that was so great. the poison number was so clever.
It actually, like, you may have noticed there's a weird little cut before the poison. It's the only kind of obvious cut in this film, which, as Keith mentioned, was filmed over a two-night stand, January 1st and 2nd. But yeah, there's like a little transition, like a flip screen transition. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, that was
awkward. How did they do that? How did they get from there to there? And the thing disappeared.
Well, the reason is because in the set list, it was part of a medley along with Jungle Boogie and Murder.
Oh.
So I'm not sure what Murder song that would be, but the set list I found says it's a medley of Jungle Boogie, Murder, and Poison.
Yeah.
So apparently those did not make the cut, but we just jumped right to Poison.
Had to make some choices.
Yeah.
But I think one choice that he does make, and Keith mentioned this, that's certainly different from Talking Heads, is to open with all of these introductions, which I found a hugely effective strategy, because you there's so many of them.
Yeah, and everyone. It's like laser technician, assistant laser technician.
Yeah, and they all get to say who they are, where they're from, and you just get enough of them to, you know, just to make note of the face, and they'll come back later as dancers, as guitarists, as percussionists. And
it's my turn for some fun trivia.
Sure.
A la Keith, the dancer who singles himself out as the token Russian is Ivan from season 8 of So You Think You Can Dance.
Oh, really?
Yes. So if you enjoyed his work here, you can look up some other Ivan dancing videos on YouTube.
Wow.
That'd be a kind of weird thing to do, but
that is good trivia, because he actually did stand out just for that line, saying he's a token Russian. But I think you these introductions, you get an early sense of the scope of this production for one, and just how much goes into just staging the damn thing. Mm-hmm. And then you get an appreciation for how all of these parts will coalesce as smoothly as they do. And then on top of that, you know, you get that great scene of Timberlake and company huddling together for a prayer and kind of a psych up session, and some of the emotions of this tour that they've been on for 2 years coming to an end, and that comes out. I mean, you can tell. Either you can tell, or Timberlake is an unbelievably impressive actor, that they are close, and they meant something to all of them, and they had a great experience. And you know, there's something bittersweet about doing this again, you know, two more times, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that he is genuinely moved and emotional. Like at the end, during Mirrors, there's that shot of him just tearing up, you know. But I mean, like, he's playing the last night of a almost two-year tour in front of 25,000 people. Like, I mean, I think any experience that goes on for 2 years, you know, the ending of it is going to make you emotional. Like, you know, he is an actor, but like I said, I will give him the benefit of the doubt that those emotions, both during that psych up prayer scene and the end of Mirrors, are genuine.
I think that my favorite part of this film is the home stretch too, where it's like you can feel like the experience that comes with like playing these songs over and over mm-hmm. again, but you can tell they're having fun with it, like just being, you know, the end's in sight, and there's an extra level of excitement to it. I mean, this was a joy to watch. I'm happy we chose this.
And I like how at different points they bring out certain sections of the band, you know, so the guitarists get their chance, which is a really great moment. I don't know what song it is, but it's really cool when you got three really good guitarists sort of jamming together at once, and then the percussionists, keyboardists, they all get their specific moments and dancers, and you do kind of start to connect a little bit with these faces that you've been introduced to so helpfully at the beginning of the film. And then there's stuff more broadly. I mean, the film does a couple of things. I mean, one, you get more than a great seat at an expensive show. He's showing you things that you can't see even if you do have the best seat in the house. He's taking you on stage, but then you also get, well, maybe my favorite moment in the film are the seconds before Timberlake ascends to the stage, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, you hear the crowd cheering overhead, and he steps into the contraption that's going to elevate him to the floor. And of course you never get a chance to see that.
I mean, it's actually a shot that has become, I think, pretty common in concert films. Like, I remember it distinctly in both the recent Katy Perry and Justin Bieber concert films, which you sent me to review. Thank you, Scott. and now I'm bringing that knowledge back,
the best
back to
people,
you here.
Only the best people.
Yeah, so that, like, rising up from the stage is, I think, a somewhat common shot at this time, but it is great watching Timberlake do it, especially because, like, he is so comfortable, and he's, like, joking around and, you know, giving people dap, and right up until, like, the 3 seconds before he ascends, and then you just kind of see him center himself and go up, you know, and just the way it's framed in the shot is very, very smart. But also that moment where he rises up on stage alone and he's singing a cappella, or mostly a cappella. There's some musical stings, but he's mostly unaccompanied vocals at that point for the first maybe 2/3 of the song. And then the rest of the band rises out of the stage, including like 2 drum kits rise up on either side of him, you know?
Yeah.
And that right there is like a little evocative of Stop Making Sense for me. Just like starting with the solo single figure, something very, very stripped down, and then building the rest of the band around it. And it obviously happens over the course of a single song here, as opposed to like 5. But it does kind of contribute to that same vibe of like, we are building a performance on stage for you.
And is it again that shadow play too is really mm-hmm. critical too in that shot. It's just it's the wrong band, but Larger Than Life. Like Larger Than Life.
Oh,
in that
Scott, that warms
shot.
My heart. Thank you. Look at your boy band knowledge.
I know. I correctly identified it as not in sync. But I just marveled at him as a performer in this. I mean, that was my takeaway. Just like so charismatic, so easily has the audience in his hands. I mean, there's like a stare-like grace with which he fluidly moves from singing to dancing and across the stage. I mean, he's not one of the weak links in the dancing crew. You know what I mean? You know, like oftentimes you see all these incredible dancers and the performer is sort of just carted around or is giving you this sort of half-hearted bit of choreography. And
he was the best dancer in NSYNC.
Yeah, he's the best singer too, I guess, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so
sorry, JC.
That falsetto, though, right? That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would JC be number two there?
Yeah.
As far as singing ability?
Yeah.
But he was always the star of that band, too, in the way that, I mean, I guess Jordan and the Kids on the Block was also a pretty big star.
this is just delightful to me. I love every minute
yeah,
of this.
Yeah. Anyway.
Can I just like point out my favorite shot in this film, and I think a pretty quintessentially Demi shot is during the groove get in, which might be my favorite number, where they're on the floating glass
that was cool.
platform above yeah. above the audience,
yeah,
and they're just dancing along this platform that spans the entire audience. Like, that's super cool. But then there's one shot within that performance where the camera is on stage and you see the platform in the distance with Justin Timberlake center. And then in the foreground on either side is a horn player and a guitar player. And they're kind of like framing him. They're framing this faraway shot of him in the background. And it's just like contributes to that. We're all a part of this. Like every piece matters and it's all part of a larger picture. I love that shot, even though it's Justin Timberlake tiny in the background, which is like antithetical to the whole movie. But
yeah,
you don't get that many cutaways. There's enough to give you a sense of scale. But when you go to the really big aerial shots, too, like you get a sense of like what a big venue this is, too. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much, if at all, this show was modified for the film.
Well, you know, they were 17 cameras total at work here. Declan Quinn shot the film. And again, that's Demme using an accomplished cinematographer. He shot all of Demme's later movies, and he shot films as far back as Leaving Las Vegas. So he's got a lot of skill. But, you know, you've got a bunch of cameras on stage. You got some of the audience. You have some floating around. So the territory is well covered. But again, there are choices being made conceptually about what kind of angles you want to take and what parts of the show stage you want to show and how you want to compose certain songs. I mean, I got a pretty clear, strong impression that Demme and his crew had been following this tour for a while and kind of had a sense of what the show was like and where they wanted to be during certain moments.
I've mentioned this before. I originally suggested this pairing months ago at our live show when we all came with different pairings to suggest, and Demme's sad death gave us an excuse to do it. But when I suggested it then, I brought up the fact that Timberlake came to Demme with Stop Making Sense in his head as like something he wanted to strive for. And I think that really shows both in terms of Demme's approach and how Timberlake apparently worked with him and had him on many, many stops of the tour to kind of work out all the kinks. You know, it wasn't just a filmed concert. They were making a concert film, you know?
Right.
I think that really shows.
With that, we can wind down this section. We'll be right back after this break to talk about the connections between Stop Making Sense and Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Tonight, when you're up there, look to your right, look to your left. That's who this show is for. Yes. It's for all of us. Yeah. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Enjoy it. Squeeze every drop of juice out of it.
Yeah.
Ride the tiger.
All right?
Incredible.
I love you guys.
Oh, yeah. Love you. Yeah.
What a run.
2 years.
I'll see you guys next week. All right. Cool.
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. We can start with charismatic frontmen, although these are very different sorts of charismatic frontmen. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I mean, they both do a lot of dancing.
Yes.
Well, one's really tall, and the other one's not as tall.
One of them suit fits a little better than the other one.
I feel like with Timberlake, it is one long act of seduction, and with David Byrne, it is not. that is not the vibe from
that
Byrne
is true. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think there's definitely this sex appeal thing that Timberlake has.
He brought it back.
He did bring it went away, and then it came back. Yeah, so I guess there is that difference too. But you know, we were talking right before moving on to connections about how Timberlake had come to Demme to make this movie based on Stop Making Sense, and I think that shows a lot of insight on Timberlake's part as far as his vision of the show and what the show means and how it's put together and this great collaborative party atmosphere. It shows a lot of insight into what would be appealing for Demme to make. He pitched a Jonathan Demme film to Jonathan Demme.
Yeah. And I mean, just the title, I mean, Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids was not the name of this concert tour. The concert was called the 2020 Experience, 2020 Concert Experience. I don't know, something like that. But like the name of this film is Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids. They get equal billing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the film is kind of set up to explain why in a couple of different ways. One, just by introducing us to all of them in relation to Timberlake and who kind of treats them all as equals or collaborators. And then everyone gets their moment in the on the stage, in the spotlight, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, for a show that's so focused on Justin Timberlake's considerable talents, there's a democratic spirit at play.
Yeah, for sure.
That doesn't need to be there, because this is not, you know, this is a solo tour. Mm-hmm. Really, Talking Heads are a band, so you really do have to feature all of them. But you know, people are coming to the show to see Justin Timberlake and all the things that Justin Timberlake does. And there's a lot of give and a lot of generosity on his part to make it about more than just him.
But would you also perhaps agree that to a certain segment of the population, David Byrne is the Talking Heads? I mean, obviously you guys are huge Talking Heads fans, you know, from back in the day. But I mean, like, if not for this movie and looking stuff up about Tom Hanks, I probably could not name the other Talking Heads.
Yeah.
You know, when I think of Talking Heads, I think of David Byrne.
That's true. You know, because I think I was thinking about rock bands in general, and usually you can identify the lead singer and the guitarist, right? I mean, those are the two, you know, from like Led Zeppelin to, you know, Guns N' Roses. I mean, you kind of know the lead singer and the guitarist if you are casually familiar.
Sometimes you know the drummer
from those bands, right? But you know, but if you're more into them, maybe you know, yeah, know the drummer too. But yeah, I mean, this, I guess you do identify Talking Heads with David Byrne for sure. And I mean, in a way, I mean, Stop Making Sense encourages that more. Mm-hmm. Unlike Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, it encourages you to think about, this is a David Byrne concept and production.
In 1990, I saw a concert called the Escape from New York Tour, which was at the Kings Island Amusement Park, which if you've ever seen episodes of Brady Bunch where they go to the amusement park, that's Kings Island in Cincinnati.
Home of the Beast. Right?
Home of the Beast, that's right.
What about the Screaming Demon?
Screaming Demon was also there. And they may still have a concert venue, and I went to see this tour, which was Debbie Harry, another Jonathan Demme favorite. The Ramones, which I'm glad I saw them. And then the Tom Tom Club with Jerry Harrison. So three quarters of the Talking Heads. And they did a lot of Talking Heads songs without David Byrne. I can tell you, David Byrne brought something, to the band.
Yeah.
So you're saying you would not be rushing out to see the Tennessee Kids concert?
Oh, I don't know. Sure. But the point I'm trying to draw is Talking Heads, it was a band, you know?
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, the thing about the Tennessee Kids, too, as well, is that I think they're such good musicians that in the wrong hands, or if the show were not particularly well thought out, they could come off as just studio hands, because they're freaking great. Yeah. Like all of them are like kind of great you don't necessarily even want on an album sometimes or in a band, because it's too perfect. Mm. But that's not the way that they're worked in here. They are given, just, you know, I mean, you can appreciate their high level of craft while also just getting to how much fun they're having and how much personality they bring it as individuals.
Yeah, I think another connection here is that they're both performers that had to take something that's very much built in the studio. It's very much a product of production. Mm. I mean, they'd made three albums before this with Brian Eno. This was them producing, you know, Speaking in Tongues on their own. That's Talking Heads, not Justin Timberlake. Okay. I'd love to hear a Timberlake, you know, collaboration. But these are all, you know, and then Timberlake, you know, he acknowledges Timbaland and the audience. These are not like, you know, loose improvisational records that are put together. These are very much constructed things. Mm-hmm. And to turn that into a live experience that it stays true to the spirit of the records that people love while also giving them an amazing live experience. That's a magic trick that both of them had to figure out how to pull off here.
And in Vegas, too, which can be a pretty sterile place, given its reputation. You feel kind of like you're being shuffled around the place and handled and surveilled, and it's not a very spontaneous place to be, despite its reputation. And I think that can kind of bleed into, there's a danger of that bleeding into the shows that you go and see. I mean, if you go to a Vegas show, if you go to, like, say, the Celine Dion show, how much is that show going to change from one performance to the next? I mean, it's pretty much going to be exactly the same. It's like going through on the It's a Small World After All ride or something, you know. But there's enough here where it's, I mean, it is certainly planned to the second. I don't deny that. But, you know, it does have that sensuality to it and that, you know, excitement and dynamism that I think Timberlake is trying to bring to the show. That comes through despite the location and despite, you know, the planning, the heavy planning that went into it.
Yeah, taking that into account, I mean, both of these films have to... We talked a little bit before about Demme's other concert films, the Storefront Hitchcock, and you know, Heart of Gold, a Neil Young film, was a shot at the Ryman Auditorium. Yeah. With all of these, I get the sense that you really get a sense of place. I mean, this is not an intimate venue in any way, and Demme doesn't really try to make it more intimate than it would be. You know, the Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense, is sort of a mid-sized theater kind of thing. Storefront Hitchcock is actually, you know, filmed in a storefront. It's a tiny space, never meant to be a concert anywhere. How do you feel like he handles those spaces in each film?
I think they're critical. I think they're critical to every one of those films. I mean, you mentioned Neil Young. Heart of Gold was shot in the Ryman in Nashville, which is the definition of an intimate venue or the type of venue I think you'd really want to see Neil Young perform at. It's not large. It's historic. It's acoustically pleasing. There's a warmth to it. Mm-hmm. And that comes through in the performance. You know, and then, you know, Talking Heads, I think, you don't necessarily get a sense of the venue that much, but, you know, again, he lets in enough of the audience to where you get that feeling of excitement in the room. This is another story, of course. I was playing with Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, playing in the MGM Grand in front of a sold-out crowd is like 24,000 people. You know, I again, appreciate how much he was able to bring in the audience and give you that feeling of a packed arena show where everyone is sort of on the hook and there's all the excitement and people are lighting their phones like their lighters and all this other stuff. One thing he never ever does is he never cuts away to like individual people kind of like grooving to whatever's going on, thank God.
Which is something you get so much in modern concert films, especially with artists in the kind of in the Timberlake realm. Again, I'm thinking of the Bieber documentary.
Yeah, I don't think that serves it well. So you do get a sense of the size of the venue and you bring in that collective energy and that informs the film and it gives you a sense of the space that Timberlake and this band have to fill, you know, have to entertain. I mean, it's a whole nother story than even the Talking Heads. And then of course you look at the other things too. I mean, Storefront Hitchcock is a perfect, conceptually simple, but perfect way to give you Robin Hitchcock in a certain way, you know, in Swimming to Cambodia, which is like, you know, a performance film, but you could say also a concert film. He's using multiple cameras and sound effects and other things to enhance and bring out the most in that performance in a way that, you know, in every single case, it's more than what you would get if you were actually just there.
I think in Stop Making Sense, the focus is much more on the stage as opposed to the venue as a whole. And it like that kind of contributes to the sense of the performance almost as a play or something, like, you know, in the whole thing with the set being built, which, speaking of, we talked about the opening of Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids. But I think it's interesting that the credits go over the load in to the venue, not the load out, which is kind of what you would expect for closing credits, that you see that being the set being struck, you know. Mm-hmm. But this is not that. It's going back to the beginning and showing you how it all came together after the fact, after seeing the full picture before that.
Yes, one other thing we could talk about is where this caught everyone at other places in their careers. We talked about how this was a, you know, pivotal moment for the Talking Heads, where they came for the rest of their career, which was which was really a mere three albums, not counting the Stop Making Sense soundtrack. They were a studio only band, and then Timberlake, I guess, I'm not sure what he's going to do next. You know, he did that song from Trolls, which people don't like that song. I don't think it's a great song.
Oh, it was like the song of the summer.
Yeah, but I think that slagged in a lot of like year-end stuff.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people resented it being in the Oscar discussion because it was Trolls. I don't know.
Whatever.
But also the song came out like months and months before Trolls, which I think...
Was it as Trolls specific as it needed to be?
Yeah. I think it's just fine that it wasn't.
I thought it made for a good Oscar moment. I thought it was kind of a cool way to open the Oscars. But again, that was controversial as well.
Yeah.
People hate stuff.
People hate joy. People hate fun.
This might have also been the end of Timberlake as a, you know, full-time, you know, this might be the longest tour he ever mounted. You know, I'm not sure. He's got a lot of other things he does beyond recording and touring. touring? Does this, yeah. This might have been a similar moment for him. We don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be surprised if it was the end of his recording and touring career, but I think it's the 2020 experience was like the end of a phase. It like kind of is the cap on his transition from teeny bopper former boy band member to respected pop artist. You know, like that's what the 2020 experience album was. That's why it was so big and bloated and, you know, personal. And
he sort of taken some time away too, because he was working in movies and
right.
I mean, how big of a gap was there again?
7 years roughly. Yeah, Future Sex Love Sounds was 2006, and that was a huge album. So, but then he came back with a very large two-part album. Mm-hmm. So, you know, careful what you wish for, I guess. But
yeah,
like, I mean, I think kind of if you look at his three solo albums, Justified, Future Sex Love Sounds, and the 2020 Experience, is kind of like his coming into his own as a serious artist trilogy. You know, this can definitely kind of be seen as a cap on that, and I would not be at all surprised if he continues his forays into acting for the time being. Mm. But I also think that he's just too much of a inherent performer to ever step away from music entirely. And I think we see from the way that he commands the audience here that it's a part of him.
Yeah, I mean, not to get too much into the psychology of it too, but I mean, he's been doing this since Mickey Mouse Club. Yeah. I mean, there had to have been a point where he just felt burnt out. Maybe that explains that 7 year gap. Maybe he had a little bit of Justin time.
Right? Justin time.
you need a little time to be himself, But this was exciting, and it was such a good idea to bring in Demi, and I think it's a nice capper to this huge album, and being on tour for 2 years to be able to have the director of the greatest concert film ever made make this film and make it his final film. I mean, it would turn out to be his final film. That's a pretty great thing.
Yeah, I mean, like talking about cappers, how do you feel about this as Demi's final film? Like, does it feel right? I mean, obviously, we're always going to be sad that there are not more Demi films in the world and, you know, that this is the last one we get. But are we upset that this is the last one we get?
I'm not upset. It doesn't feel like the most appropriate final Demi film.
I mean, actually, technically, I guess the last Demi thing we had was a episode of Shots Fired that aired there the night he died.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, that was Demi's thing. I mean, he was not a snob. Like, I mean, he worked across a lot of different types of film and television and music videos, you know, like, there was no elitism, I think, to his career. So, you know, I guess it's appropriate.
I never really characterize that sort of thing as elitism. I mean, I think you have certain filmmakers who really have control over their filmography and when everything they do, if it's Quentin Tarantino or Paul Thomas Anderson or Wes Anderson to some extent, it's going to be an event and something that they work on, and that's going to be their thing. I think Demi was, like you said, much looser because he made so many documentaries that very few people saw, and that some are not available. I saw one, is it Cousin Bob?
Cousin Bobby. Mm-hmm.
Cousin Bobby. I saw Cousin Bobby back in the day. You can't find that anymore, and it's wonderful. It's just a wonderful little movie. I think he's not overly precious about his
precious
controlling,
was the word I was
right,
looking
yeah,
for. Yeah,
yeah, about controlling every single thing he did. He could do small projects. He could come in and direct the fifth or sixth episode of Shots Fired because he cares about, you know, the subject matter. You know, he was not that controlling about his filmography. So that's
he also took some hits too. I mean, like Beloved was not well received and was not a huge commercial hit. And it, you know, it was his follow up to Philadelphia, and I'm no doubt eyed by some, if not Demi himself, as a big Oscar contender. And it just wasn't that. And Truth About Charlie, right, which is a delightful film in many ways, was not a hit. Manchurian Candidate remake was not, I don't think that was a hit.
No, but it's so good. Like that,
is it? I need to revisit.
I think
that.
It's really.
I thought it was fine.
I think it's really underrated and really smart.
But he regroups and does a little movie like Rachel Getting Married, which is amazing and is all him. And, you know,
let's not forget Ricky and the Flash, our beloved Ricky and the Flash, which is his last feature.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course, you know, his last feature, his last documentary, both about music. In that sense, it's pretty fitting.
Yeah. And trivia, Bernie Worrell, the late Bernie Worrell, was in Ricky and the Flash as well. So there's, I mean, he has this habit of working with people over and over again. I was just putting together a playlist of Demi songs and Demi films for here. And like, you know, he's hold on to artists for a long, long time. I mean,
and actors that he loves to put in.
Actors he loves to put in,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
There's a little, just the through line that, you know, the band that turned up in Demi stuff throughout his career was the Feelies, which is this great band from New Jersey that was critically acclaimed and definitely more of a cult act. And I could not recommend them more highly. But a little bit of trivia from Glenn Kenny's appreciation of Jonathan Demme when he died was he was trying to make a film, a concert film of the Feelies called Night of the Living Feelies. And among the people he pitched it to who said no was the manager of the Talking Heads, which is how he ended up making Stop Making Sense, if that piece of trivia is correct. But, yeah.
Could have been a different thing. I discovered the Feelies through Married to the Mob. The song Too Far Gone is in that film, and then I bought the record that was on and other Feelies albums, and
they're in Something Wild, the prom band or the reunion band and Something Wild. That's actually the Feelies.
And all of his Corman buddies and certain character actors and producers would kind of turn up in his films too. So there's kind of a family quality to them.
Robin Hitchcock, as it turns up, as a bad guy in The Manchurian Candidate, is actually pretty chilling, and I don't think he's a scary guy, but that's he's made scary there.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I had a feeling this would turn into a Jonathan Demme love fest by the end of it, and before we get any more off the track of the two films we came here to talk about, we should probably wind down. But you can find Stop Making Sense on Blu-ray and DVD. I highly recommend the Blu-ray. There's lots of cool features on that. It's also on the usual streaming services, and you can watch Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids on Netflix, where it debuted and still is. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
Well, I thought I'd go with another Netflix exclusive.
Okay.
Called Casting JonBenet.
You stole mine!
Did I really?
It's okay, I have a second one.
Okay. this is a very unusual and conceptually...
I should have known. I should have known, because it's such Scott Tobias bait. Go ahead.
It really is, because it's like a really super concept-oriented, aesthetically-minded documentary. Premiered at Sundance. It's currently on Netflix. It was a Netflix production. Never found its way to the theaters, which, again, is a gripe for another day. But this is a film by Kitty Green. She put out a casting call for a fake fictional film about JonBenet Ramsey. She did it in the Colorado Springs area where the child was murdered. And the film is basically a highly stylized mix of talking head interviews with the actors auditioning and scripted scenes of them playing JonBenet, John and Patsy Ramsey, and other people associated with the case. You know, all the kids auditioning to play JonBenet and her brother were not even born when the murder took place. But the adults all have a fascinating array of emotions and feelings and theories about this case. The film is often hilarious and sad, too, and full of different weird interpretations of the truth. And it's got kind of an Errol Morris-like curiosity about the quirks of human nature. There's a character in there who's auditioning for the part of John Ramsey, who's like a sex instructor.
And he gets the part, I think.
He does, but he also gives us some good information about various instruments of whatever.
Cat of nine tails,
right, exactly.
Versus a flogger.
I know, it's like, it's a lot of detail, and plus, you're done in 80 minutes.
Yeah.
That's it, 80 minutes of your time. It's a pretty major film. It was really well liked at Sundance for good reason, and it's just sitting there on Netflix, just sitting there.
Yeah, I'll piggyback on this recommendation, which was also going to be my recommendation. But yeah, it's like, I'm not usually interested in true crime as a genre of storytelling, so I was like not at all interested in this until I read what it really was, and then I became much more interested in it and was very much rewarded for my curiosity, because it's so interesting. And I think it's interesting to hear these people who are auditioning kind of like sharing their own personal experiences and then seeing how those experiences color how they viewed the sensationalized tabloid story of the JonBenet murders and what their own experience brings to their experience of that story. And it ends up telling a much bigger story, I think, just kind of about, well, A, about this town, because I think it was Boulder, not Colorado Springs.
Okay, I thought it was Colorado Springs. Sorry about that.
You know.
It is Boulder.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you do kind of end up getting a little, like, a profile of the town, and there is, you know, kind of a lot said in the film about, you know, Boulder's dark side, I guess, apparently has a pedophilia problem or had, you know? So, like, you get that bigger story, but then even on top of that, you get a kind of a much bigger story about how we engage with tabloid culture and sensational stories like this. And it's, I second that recommendation. Keith, have you seen it?
I haven't, no. No. I was wondering, are you actually going to recommend another film, too?
Not a film. I had what was going to be a supplementary recommendation, but now I guess it's my only recommendation. but it's not actually a film, or if it is, it's a very, very short one. But it's in the spirit of what we were talking about today. So I wanted to recommend the music video for Rock's sister act Haim's new song, which is called Right Now.
So good.
It's a one-shot video directed by none other.
No, it's not one-shot.
Oh, well, it's...
it's got one. It opens with one very long shot.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Where's the cut? Is it when it goes behind the booth?
No. There are several cuts towards the end.
Okay.
But it does start with one... Go ahead.
It's a long shot music video directed by none other than Paul Thomas Anderson, who has quite a few music videos under his belt, and... most of them are very interesting, and this is one of them. I'm recommending this for two reasons. The first being that it's just a really great song, and you should hear it, but also because it fits into a lot of what we've been talking about with Stop Making Sense and Justin Timberlake. The long shot approach allows both the song and the video to build and develop in this really interesting way, and Anderson uses both camera movement and sound techniques to create this immersive you-are-there experience in the middle of these three sisters building this song, instrument by instrument and layer by layer. It's really neat. It's about 4.5 minutes long, so there's really no reason to not take a few minutes and check it out if you haven't already.
Yeah, I really love this video, and I've watched it several times, so I can confirm there's some cuts, but not at the beginning. And it's just like the blocking on this thing is just miraculous, and I can't imagine how long it took to get it right, because you're talking about like slivers of the frame that are at the right place at the right time, and really get that. I guess that's a musical thing of just like knowing when to strike that note and being there when you need to be there. So it's really fun to watch the timing of it, and it really enhances, you know, the musicality of sisters and how they kind of come with their collaboration and their abilities. You know, once when they pick up the sticks and start drumming,
there's Foley too. Like you like hear the sticks clicking together.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't tell if it was added after the fact or if it was just because it was close to the mic, but.
Yeah.
That's what I mean when I say like he uses sound techniques to create the feeling that you're there in the studio with them and you're hearing these little bits of ambient noise.
Yeah, you know, the connection between it and Daydreaming, the Radiohead song, is just like a sense of just movement and fluidity and mood. It really just puts you in a state, this video, and I think it has to do with the movement of the camera and the sustaining of longer shots and that sort of thing. And you definitely feel like you're seeing a very directed... thing, but great, really great, and it's a good song.
Yeah, that's a good band. I like him.
Well, what about you, Keith?
Sure, I'm going to recommend a film I saw at a film festival. I went to a film festival, guys.
I never go to film festivals,
and I went to the Overlook Film Festival, which was held at the Timberline Lodge in Oregon, which is where they shot the exteriors for The Shining, which is to say about 30 seconds of the actual footage. Because
the hedge maze isn't there, Keith.
Hedge maze is not there, and except for one shot, I don't believe there's any shots with actors. There's like one shot of Shelley Duvall and the kid. That's actually the Timberline. Other than that, it's all reconstructed in England with a madman like precision by Stanley Kubrick. But they had a horror movie festival there, and it was so cool. And I saw a lot of good stuff there. And I may mine it for other recommendations later. But the one I'd recommend is a movie you can see by the time you're listening to this. You can go watch it on VOD, or if you live in a town with an art house showing it. It's called Hounds of Love, and it's an Australian film from a new director named Ben Young, who I think we'll probably be hearing his name some more. It is a tough film, guys. It's a it's a tough sit, as I say, but it's so skillfully done and smart and complex that all those qualities overwhelm the sort of repulsiveness of the situation. It is a set in 1987 Perth, and it's about a couple played by Emma Booth and Stephen Curry, who is best known as a comedian in Australia, although it's kind of hard to YouTube clips of him when you have your name is spelled exactly the same as one of the most famous basketball players.
I was about to say, also known as a great shooting guard for the Golden State Warriors.
But they are a couple, a fairly monstrous couple who kidnaps teenage girls and hold them hostage and do horrible things and then kill them. And this is the story of one girl they kidnapped, played by Ashley Cummings. She's kidnapped and sort of kind of like starts to see cracks in their relationship and tries to realize that her only way out is to kind of play them against each other. And it's this really, I forget who I was talking to at the festival, but you take out all the murder and abuse and kidnapping, and it's still like this really interesting portrait of a abusive, dysfunctional relationship. It's, like I said, fair warning, this is not a pleasant film in any sense of the word, but it's so skillfully done from the acting to the filmmaking that I highly recommend it.
Well, that sound you hear is Scott running toward the theater and me running away from
it. Yep. That's exactly how I would. That's exactly what I would suggest.
Australian. There seems to be some torture in there.
Yeah.
I'm on board.
Yeah, right. It's called extreme horror, Scott.
I like it.
And that's it for this week's edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out May 30th and June 1st. Scott, what do we have lined up?
Well, years ago, the notion of a big screen version of Baywatch sounded about as appealing as a big screen version of Baywatch. And while we haven't seen it yet, as of this recording, the new action comedy starring The Rock and Zac Efron is being released with a certain amount of confidence and swagger, I would say, by the studio releasing it. The trailers seem to suggest that Baywatch has been blessed with a certain amount of comic self-awareness among its more prurient assets. We've seen that happen too recently with the 21 Jump Street movies, another marginal TV enterprise given a fresh take and new life as a film franchise. But those movies weren't the first to pull off that trick. For our next episodes, we're going back a little further to 1995's The Brady Bunch movie, which offered a good lesson in how to turn small screen dross into big screen gold. We may talk a little bit about the sequel too, so get watching.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Stop Making Sense and Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730, and we'd love getting those, or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve?
I am the Deputy Culture Editor at Vox.com at the Culture section there, and you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky.
I am on Twitter at Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work in the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Vulture, Variety, UpRocks, Guardian, and other fine publications.
And I'm the Editorial Director of Film and Television at UpRocks. You can find me there at UpRocks.com and on Twitter at KFIPS3000. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at NextPicturePod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/NextPictureShow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keeps the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show, and thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing recording space at her home base, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be a part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time. Show me a light now. I'll tell you.